super strong, supernatural, and super bad. His punch can topple a skyscraper. His kick can split the earth in two. More destructive than an earthquake, mightier than a tidal wave. A one-man disaster area.
42nd Street Pete.
Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked.
42nd Street Pete.
Okay, we had Kyra on last week, Kyra Shan from Night of the Living Dead, and we apologize for the shortness of time because we were besieged with tornadoes out where Todd lives, and as I speak, we had an earthquake a couple days ago. There's a hurricane barreling down toward New York City, and we had a tornado in my neighborhood last night, so things are looking up, but be that as it may, you know, we were talking a lot about Night of the Living Dead. And we were also talking about a very cool documentary I just watched called Autopsy of the Dead. And tonight we have here, live, we have Jim Cirinella, the producer, Jeff Carney, the director, and Gary Striner, who is part of the cast and the crew from the original Night of the Living Dead. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
My pleasure. What made you guys decide to make a documentary?
I think it was really a passion for the film. I had started, this is Jeff Carney, I had started trying to track everyone down around the 25th anniversary of the document, of the original film. And I ran into Jim a couple years ago and we started talking and I found out he was kind of doing the same thing on his own, trying to do interviews on his own. And we finally figured out, since we both have a love for the film, why not do it together? And it was a great choice because he was a great person to go into business with in putting this thing together.
If you notice, the documentary doesn't feature the usual suspects. We really wanted to have a lot of the people that you never hear from or have never heard from before that were behind the film. And that was really the start of the whole thing. We figured if we can't get, you know, X amount of new people that, you know, no matter what their contribution was, we wanted to get a lot of new content and a lot of new voices that you haven't heard from before, and also do it before anybody else passes away, because we've already lost so many people from this film, and, you know, that contributed to it in one way or another, and, you know, made it the unique film that it is. So that was really our, you know, what got us going on doing this documentary.
And of course, Gary was, you know, on the original crew. He was part of the posse, and I believe you said in the documentary that you also were one of the original owners of the film too.
Yeah, I was one of the original Image 10, which was ultimately the corporation that made it. That was a sister company to the Leighton Image, which George and Russ and Jack Russo and Bill Heinzman and I had been doing. It's funny, I don't remember for how many years. I think it was only two or three, but it seemed like about 15. But we spent a long time together. I mean, I was with the Leighton Image all told for, I think, 11 years, something like that, which was a fun ride. It's a crazy thing to have this as part of your history, and I think in a way that's what you know, I liked about Autopsy and what interested me in Jim and Jeff's project was that, you know, it did look for some of the lesser known people who, very interestingly, through them, I found people that I hadn't talked to in many, many years. In some cases, probably 40 years. So it was fun for me to know that guys like Bill Birch and all were still alive, and Joe Unitas, and, you know, people who I knew and grew up with, and then separated from for 40 years.
It was also a learning experience for us. Just from the fact that we had a general idea of a lot of the people that we wanted to be involved and we wanted to interview, and just from the names and credits, and you don't really know what anybody's contributed until you start talking to people, and finding one or two people lead you to two more, and then you find out somebody that's is still alive that hasn't been mentioned at all, that's done a lot of work on the film, or you know, has worked in other films. You know, it just keeps leading you to other people, and you get a better picture of how the whole thing was put together. And it's really, and you know, it's a very unique film, and you can't really, you know, like talking to, being able to interview Gary and get his whole take and everything. You find out a lot more. Nobody really had one particular job that they're credited for on this film. You know, people had their hands in all different areas. So it's although the credits say one thing, it's hard to just put people in that one, you know, area and say, well, this is really all that they did.
Yeah, and you're shining light on that now, which is very cool, because, you know, this film's over 40 years old, and we were talking like last week, and we showed it down at the Pioneer Two Boots Theater before it closed up. Matter of fact, it was the last show. It was Halloween 2008 at a midnight show, standing room only, and people reacted the same way they did back when I saw it in 69. So that, you know, says a lot for the longevity and the power that film still holds over people.
Well, I like the example of Bill Hinesman is the best. I mean, he's known as, you know, the first zombie in the film. He makes his way through the whole film, actually. You know, it was one of the things we talked about, because that wasn't planned. And, you know, him actually being the cemetery zombie was an afterthought, and it was the last thing that they filmed, which, you know, Gary could tell you more about that. But that's what Bill's known for, and that amounts to one part of a day's work. And he actually was there behind the scenes, you know, and contributed a lot more to that. But, you know, people don't know that, and it's not reflected in the credits, and it's just, you know, Bill Hinesman, the cemetery zombie.
Well, yeah, that's a good point, though, Jim. I mean, you say that I could tell you more about it. It's really kind of untrue. Paul McCartney a couple of years ago was on the David Letterman show, and David Letterman asked him, so how long before you came to America were the Beatles popular? And he just sat there for like, and it seemed like 30 seconds, 40 seconds, saying nothing, and then he just broke up and kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, 3 days. You know, he didn't know. And he said that's the kind of thing that you really got to ask a fan. The fans know all that stuff. And I think what you and Jeff have done here is a really good thing, because we lived it, you know. I mean, back when it was happening and you were doing it, there was no future projection of success or anything else going on. So it was just what you did every day when you got up and went to work. And so a lot of it just kind of all washes and blends together. I think what is great about Autopsy, and what I think is also great about fans in general, is that, you know, they're not satisfied with just what the picture is. You know, I mean, once that kind of, you know, that aspect of it for a diehard fan, you know, once the glow of the actual film wears off, they want to know all the bits and particulars in the background, and they'll go, as Jim and Jeff have exampled, we'll go to major extremes to find those details out, where, you know, if you were part of it, you didn't think that way, you know. You just, so all of a sudden, you know, 40 years later, you're being asked questions about, you know, some aspect of the thing, and it's like, you know, I mean, the best you can do is kind of, paint a vague picture of what it was. But some things are very prominent, you know, and some things stand out, you know, very well. But sort of the subtle details of it all just have kind of blended all away. And I think when you get a group like you guys got together to do it, it's fun for me watching the film. And number one, these are all my my peers at the time. You know, these are all, and all remain friends. I mean, for the most part, you know, there were lots of bumps along the roads and departures and reconnections and all that sort of stuff. But I think we all remain pretty good friends to this day. So it's a real joy.
That's really one of the stories behind Night of Living Dead that really attracted me to it. Was not only was it a great movie, but the reason it was a success, in my opinion, was the talent and the teamwork behind the film. You know, independent filmmakers today could probably learn quite a bit from seeing how they worked in that film back when they made it in the 60s. They didn't let budget, you know, get in their way. They didn't let the fact they were in Pittsburgh get in their way. They went out and they made a great movie regardless of their situation. And it all boiled down to talent and teamwork.
As I say, Pete knows about this more than anybody because you're an expert on Grindhouse, and you know I'm sure you kind of roll your eyes when people consider Grindhouse today. In the '60s and '70s, I mean, if you were a small guy going against the majors, you had to, you know, have ingenuity on your side. You didn't, you know, first of all, you had to, you know, you actually had to work and have skill. You couldn't just point a video camera. You know, which doesn't take as much skill as using a film camera. You know, you had to really know what you were doing, and then you know, if you had no money, well, all you could rely on is your ingenuity and trying to come up with some angle that the majors weren't doing at all. And you know, there's kind of a very cynical way, say, you know, gore is used today, if you want to call it that, you know, different than how it was done in Night of the Living Dead, and how that film, like, set a precedent and raised a bar and broke some taboos, whatever you want to call it. Now it's just, you know, to me, then it was done for entertainment, and it was done in a certain way to shock the audience, and now it's just, you know, I don't know what people really, you know, or filmmakers are really using it for, but it's, you know, it seems to me it's more done cynical, in a cynical way than it is to actually entertain everybody.
You know, here's the thing: when you really, really think of it, this was the first authentic American horror film. I mean, you know, right. We were making movies up until that, but it was always, you know, the Frankenstein riff on the classics, then the big right. bugs of the 50s and stuff like this. This one just, like, came out of nowhere, and I said it before, and I'll say it again. I had the shit scared out of me walking into the theater because there was so much buildup that I'd heard, because I saw it in 69 on a double bill with Slaves. And we got in there, and the music starts, and the car's going up the thing, and I'm like, I don't know if this was a good idea. You know?
Well, I think it's going to be, it's eventually not just going to be the great American horror movie. It's going to be known as the great American movie. I mean, it's, you know, this is a great case of, you know, how else could a movie like this be made but in America? You know, you know, this is like the American dream, everybody working together and on very little money, they do something better than all the studios with all the money in the world couldn't do back then. And,
well, you know,
Gary will tell you, Gary will tell you about this. We had when we were at Cinema Wasteland, this woman comes up, I guess the way she was dressed, you know, like a model or a screen queen or something. And, you know, and I had to apologize later to Gary. I had to apologize to somebody because my thought when she walked up was going to be, oh, what's going to come out of this one's mouth? It's probably not going to be too deep. And she actually said, she was looking at the photos we had in Night of the Living Dead, and she said, you know, she goes, it's disheartening that to look at this and know that I'll never be in something that's as great or as lasting as this film. So she actually came up with something very profound.
Wow.
And that's, you know, that's the truth. I mean, there's really nothing else like this movie. And, there's nothing made today or in the last, you know, 20, 30 years that has the same kind of impact or longevity, or, you know, you could watch it again. There's so many interesting things to see in it.
Yeah, they're still showing it on pay cable. When I left Jersey, I don't know what system you have, Jim, because you're still there, but they were still showing it. I think it was on Encore or something. pay cable?
Well, people have been, you know, a few wise guys have been advancing the theory, or, you know, again, people that don't really, you know, the current disease is that people don't think before they speak. You know, maybe it'd be best to shut up and listen to, you know, to people like yourself who were there when this movie was first coming out, and, you know, other movies that know the history of how these things were released and what, you know, what the climate was like and what filmmakers had to do back then. But as a theory, people have been saying was, well, maybe it's the public domain aspect and that, you know, people can just rip it off. That's what actually has made it last. And that's not true at all. I mean, you would know that because if you were growing up in the 70s like I was and there was no VHS and there was no, you know, and I mean, as a kid, so I couldn't really, you can't go to the theater by yourself. And if you were growing up in that time, you know, your only outlet to watch this stuff was TV. And that's how I was exposed to Night of the Living Dead, probably about 5 years after it was made. And, you know, and it was a shock because I didn't see it coming. And, you know, we were kids. We, you know, on TV was, you know, things like Frankenstein and Dracula. And, you know, I was already several generations removed from that. That wasn't scary. It was fun. And now all of a sudden, here comes this movie that's the real deal. And I think, regardless of, you know, whether it got on TV as part of a paid package or, you know, somebody ripping the filmmakers off, somehow Night of the Living Dead, maybe because it was black and white, it squeaked through. And they didn't realize what they had. And they didn't say, hey, this, you know, film has a reputation. We have to either cut some of the scenes out or we maybe not show it at all because people are going to be, you know, going out of their minds. And somehow it got through, and it was packaged with all the other, you know, late night films, and that's what gave it the longevity. People that would have never experienced it at that time, when it was the right time to do it, it just kind of popped up, you know, on TV.
Channel 7 at 1 o'clock in the morning,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Actually, Channel 7 at 11:30, that was its...
Yeah,
once a year, and I would watch that religiously.
Yeah, but do you remember? Remember the second time they showed it? They put a disclaimer on it because people thought when you looked at the TV, it was real, and they were calling it.
We had Chuck Craig, the gentleman who was the newscaster in the film, and was also a zombie and played or a ghoul and played several other parts. And he was, you know, he comes from a real news background and an announcing background, and. You know, I told him, I said, hey, the first time I saw that film, I could attest that running along the bottom of the screen during your scenes, behind those newscasting scenes, it said a dramatization.
Yeah, right,
and
exactly.
I was, you know, I couldn't have even been maybe 7 or 8 years old, and I'm saying to my parents, what does a dramatization mean? Like, what? And they're like, well, it means it's not real. Well, why do you have to put that on a horror film? But obviously they had to.
People were buying it. You know, if you had an old black and white TV and you just tuned in and you saw that scene, you're like, oh shit, something really bad's going down.
Right. I mean, you know, that's the, and again, you know, now there's the ingenuity that we were talking about, you know, people with not a lot of money, but, you know, with, you know, just these great little, besides the, you know, great overall idea, the direction they decided to go with this, because it could have been, you know, very hokey. You know, another common thing is, oh, this movie is just like fill in the blank. And it's like, well, obviously it's not just like fill in the blank, because then those movies would be, you know, held up in the same regard. You know, something like Last Man on Earth, it's a great film. As, you know, Vincent Price, you know.
Yeah.
How could you not love that film? I mean, how could you not love, if you're a horror fan, you have to love almost anything Vincent Price is in, because he was a wonderful actor and he completely sells you on the idea. But it's not the same thing. You obviously are watching Vincent Price and you're not watching, you know, a group of unknown actors, at least at the time, that you're saying, who are these people? You know, is this really happening? What is going on? You know, so it really sells the concept to you. And all the little touches that didn't make it cheesy, but made it original and made it, you know, to sell the concept to the audience realistically. You know, a crazy concept of dead bodies rising and attacking the living.
Well, the cast seemed like they could be your neighbors. That was the thing. And the location seemed like they could be from your town. I know when I saw it on the local creature feature, I would have sworn that cemetery was the one 10 miles from my house.
Right.
And it just had that local feel to it. No matter where you were, you could relate to it.
I think that's one of the biggest parts of its success, which was, you know, the people in the film, you know, reminded you of your uncle, your aunt, your next door neighbor, your, you know, because in fact they were, you know, they weren't really actors and actresses, you know, they were people out of real life playing parts, you know. You know, yes, you know, several obviously included Ben and Barbara and, you know, Carl and Marilyn were professional performers, but they weren't professional actors and actresses, per se. And I think that all just, I think that all helped to, you know, just to sow that edgy, kind of dark, not too slick, all that stuff, just instead of kind of going against it, which happens in a lot of films, it went towards supporting the idea because of what the idea was, you know, and that's the stuff, you know, that's like in my mind is you know, that's just complete circumstance, but and its power comes from just complete circumstance, but. I think that there was enough seed of a bright filmmaker and a bright visionary like George at that point in his life that, you know, he had the ability to say, okay, here's how I can capitalize on these things rather than, oh, geez, I got an actress here that can't deliver a line. You know, he also blended that into the fabric of what Night of the Living Dead became, and so I think it was probably more than a whole lot of pluses. It was a whole lot of sort of minuses and a whole lot of mistakes that actually came together to make the film so bone-chillingly real. You know, that you thought, wow, I mean, this could happen. You know, and at that time, and there was, you know, the lack of you know, any sort of sophisticated special effects, you know, I think really, really helped in this case. And, of course, you know, I go on later to say about sort of current horror films is that that's all they are. There's no idea anymore. It's just like, okay, well, we can get a couple of hot chicks and we can get some blood that will shoot 450 feet, and you know, we're going to make a lot of
that's the that's the cynical nature of the business. You know what you're like, that's the one aspect you're saying right there, which I, you know, I've run into for years, and I'm sure everybody has. That you know, that's all that the business, or that's all that people want to see, is they want to see hot chicks and they want to see gore and they want to see.
They want to see more, but they don't even know it. You know, right. I mean, I really do think they want to see more because they're disappointed. They want, you know, but and they've even grown to the point where at that same show, I think it was the Wasteland show or one of them. That it was earlier. Some guy came up and you know, as honest as anything, came up to the table and said, I'd rather see a bad zombie movie than no zombie movie at all. Right. And, I mean, what a great t-shirt.
I don't know if that was even just the one show. That was probably at many of them.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I mean, I've been a fan of this film for, you know, since before I could do many things, whereas of the age to do many things, I really couldn't care less about zombie films. I mean, they have to, you know, they have to have something to them. You know, seeing this movie was an event. Seeing Dawn of the Dead was an event. Seeing, you know, Fulci's Zombie when it came out, that was an event.
Yeah.
And now there's no more. You know, there's no more events like that.
No.
Well, see, you're a sophisticated fan, Jim. That's the difference. I mean, but there are a lot of unsophisticated horror fans. You know, and so I mean, it's a big pool of people that just are rabid for this stuff. But I mean, it gets back to the point that, you know, I think that you know, making a statement like that means that, well, that's all I can get, so I'll take it. And you know, that I just think that was so far from the point of Night of the Living Dead and so far from the energy of Night of the Living Dead. And it's kind of odd how it's sort of over the years it's morphed into becoming, you know, I don't know, just a simple genre, you know, like we can do anything. I mean, some of the films that I've seen that actually, you know, have a DVD box and a cover, and actually people on the cover that are reported to be the stars of the movies, and you just kind of get excited and you think, wow, look, this is another little independent and somebody went off and made, and you put it in, and it's just amazingly bad. I mean, not just kind of bad. It's amazingly bad. And you think that, you know, there's still an amount of energy that it took to get it to the point that, you know, somebody had a table at a convention somewhere and was selling it, you know? And it just, you just wonder where the, you know, we were so fortunate to be filmmakers, you know, first. And our desire to make films was the drive and force behind Night of the Living Dead, not to make the best film ever. We wanted to make a film. We didn't. We had no comprehension that it was going to go beyond, you know, our own personal screening of it. You know, so I you know, anyway, I'm. I might ramble a little bit with that point. Not even sure, really sure what that point is, other than...
I understand it, because people used to send me what they thought was their good movies and they wanted my critique on them. And I'd sit here and watch them, and I just email them back and I says, if I really published what I really think of this, you'd probably go hang yourself.
Well, that's the thing with Night of the Living Dead. When you watch it, you can tell from the start to the finish... those people were talented and they cared about the production, from casting to the script to finding the locations to shooting it to then going into post-production, and it's edited. The editing on that is amazing. And then they picked out fantastic stock music to use that you could have, even if you had an orchestra, you could score it. The stock music was probably a better fit. It was just everything went their way. They made all the right choices in that film.
Yeah, whatever came their way, I mean, they made use of. You know, to a lot of films, the stock music is the liability, and you know, here it was used to its full potential. You know, being able to pick the best cues and instinctively knowing how to do that. But going back to the thing Gary's talking about, you know, that comes down to not really caring about the process or being in love with the process, but wanting to be known as a filmmaker. And there's a difference. And it's in any kind of field that you go in. You know, are you a doer, or do you just want to be known for it? And if you don't love, you know, sitting there, you know, being by yourself for, you know, weeks and weeks, piecing together a film by hand the way, you know, George had to do this film, as Gary will tell you, under barbaric circumstances, or if you don't love the whole crew going out to this farmhouse and, you know, having to, you know, which basically was almost abandoned property, and sitting out there with, you know, without any conveniences. I mean, there's no running water. It's summer. It's hot. There's no air conditioning. And eking out a film in those circumstances, I mean, if you don't love the process, then why would you do that? You know,
I think a lot of independent filmmakers today are in love with the idea of being a filmmaker.
Right, exactly. They love the title, and they love, you know, being known as that, and having a table at a convention where they can say to everybody, you know, hey, you know, here's my film. And that doesn't mean that everybody's, you know, that there are people at conventions that don't, you know, have a real love for it and enjoy the process, and you know, that's what the real thrust is for them, and don't in fact make, you know, good work. But you know, independent filmmaking industry doesn't have its, you know, they don't have the monopoly on wannabes and, you know, posers.
Well, that's
you can
why,
find
that's
in
why,
any field.
that's really why films like 9/11 Gutters are rare. I mean, Bill Cardell said in one of the interviews we did with him, he said it's like touching lightning in a bottle. You had all the elements together, the talent, the teamwork, the skills, the locations, the script, the cast, everything came together at that moment in time. And thank God it did.
And just you have to be ready to make the most of what what you're dealt, and the hand that you're dealt, and the resources that you're lucky enough to get together, and that's why I don't feel a lot of what happened in the film is an accident. It was making the most out of the things that came their way, and being as creative and using as much ingenuity as possible when there's no money. And I don't think it's a mistake that we're seeing films like that now. You know, the films that really have ideas and make an impact and, people seem to be responding really well to are low-budget films being made outside of the USA because the American stuff kind of, dominates, wherever it goes. So, that sets up a situation where, people outside of that really aren't working in that area, they have to rise to the occasion and come up with something. And that's why you're seeing stuff like, Let the Right One In, made for comparatively very little money, packs a wallop. Something like this new film, Troll Hunter, packs a wallop. What else? I mean, there's been several others. Monsters by the director in the UK. I can't think of his name. Another film that's, just very, very small, amount of resources to work with, but the scope of what he's able to do with just a couple actors is amazing. And, of course, there's going to be the people that scoff at it and say, going back to what Gary said, the mentality, I'll watch any zombie movie's better than no zombie movie at all. And, they'll see something like Monsters, which has its own identity. They'll see something like, Let the Right One In, which also has its own identity. You know, it's vampires. It's not being done as vampires are being, known for being done now.
Yeah, exactly.
To Hollywood. And you'll always have people scoff and say, well, why isn't it like that? And it's like, well, you have all that stuff elsewhere. Why are you insisting that this filmmaker's vision be the same as everybody else's? Isn't that the point, that it's got to be different? And, by being different, this guy, and thinking outside of the box, this guy has managed to come up with something that's unique. And, that was the spirit behind Night of the Living Dead. Well, we'll take what we learned in all these other horror movies, the ones that are commonly, I can't tell you how many times people say, well, isn't it just like, Carnival of Souls? Isn't it just like Invisible Invader? I could say, I've seen all those films. I had probably seen most of them before I had seen Night of the Living Dead. And, I basically lived watching this stuff on TV as a kid. And, they basically distilled all the stuff from those films and, took the better aspects and said, how do we make this unique? How do we get this across to the audience? Little things like, which tell me that it wasn't a mistake, like packing everybody up and going to Washington, D.C. and just, running around the streets and filming a scene so that I could add some scope to the film. That speaks volumes about, the ingenuity that was behind, everything in this film. It wasn't just a bunch, if one or a couple aspects like that happened to work out, then you could say, yes, those are accidents, but it was just about everything seemed to work out. So that's too much of a coincidence to just call them accidents.
Well, I think the interesting thing too, just listening to this is, and something that I was thinking about is that one of the reasons for its success was that it was, made 43 years ago. So the expectations were not as high. It wasn't like, there was 6 weeks of hype prior to the film coming out. It just kind of dropped into, into society without any warning whatsoever, you know, and I think that that's kind of that whole organic nature was something that couldn't happen today, you know, because the bar is just so much higher now there because of, you know, for all the wrong reasons and for everything else, people think that, well, what I have to get in my... look how many people produce a trailer for their film before there's even a concrete script idea for the film. You know, I mean, that's kind of the modern way of doing it. Let's go out and create a kick-ass trailer, and then we can chop that around, and maybe we can pick up some money with it. And then kind of the film has to live up to the trailer. You know, it's all sort of ass backwards.
Well, the modern day take on that is that's like winning the lottery. You know, people they're playing it as if, hey, maybe we'll be lucky enough to win the lottery because yeah. Obviously that's happened to a few people. You know, make one little 10-minute thing, throw it on YouTube, and it gets noticed, and then all of a sudden, you know, you end up with $1 million budget. You know,
yeah, but unfortunately, these guys are given a $1 million budget or whatever. Dollar budget, and they have no clue as to how to actually use that money.
Right.
You know, and again, something I'm hearing in just this conversation, you know, the continual use of the word low budget, it was really a no budget film. I mean, you know, we had enough money to buy film and have it processed.
People actually don't realize that, and maybe you could explain it. They don't understand that a majority of the money that was actually spent on the film was not cash. It was a lot of it was deferred payments till later. In fact, I had somebody actually from Germany ask me about this, which was an amazing question that he put it together in his mind because he said, when I was watching the documentary, you say that the film was made in 67, and we know that it came out in 68, but how come there's a picture of a check paid to one of the extras, and it says 1969? And I said, hey, that's a really, you know, you really, you put that question together very well, you know, the way you noticed all those things. It was because
right.
there was a, you know...
That's when the funds finally came in to be able
right.
to pay them.
You guys actually, the people making the movie each put up $600, and that was 10 of you. And even from that small group, not all 10 were the key production personnel. Like, it was probably, maybe 5 or 6. And then from there brought other friends in.
Oh, yeah.
And relatives.
Yeah,
and
family, you know, and it went down, actually. Not everybody, you know, the original 10... put in, or maybe you're right. I never bothered to even think about that. And see, these are the great things about doing these interviews because it's like, well, wait a minute, now was that true? Were there really 10? I don't even think there were. I think there were 10 original investors. I'm not sure they even all put in 600. I think I'd have to actually sit down and figure it out who the actual original 10 were. I think there were 10 originals. That's right. And then that got us into production. That gave us enough cash that we could actually go to Kodak and buy the film stock. And, you know, we were so fortunate to already have all the equipment, barbaric as it was. We at least had it.
But the bottom line is that people see this figure that's thrown around, you know, that's been thrown around for years and repeated, you know, $114,000. And
right.
But the bottom line is that there was not $114,000 of cash sitting there. You guys probably had at the most of what? Well, you figure if 10 people put up $600, that was $6,000 to buy film.
Yeah.
To have a little bit of money, maybe so people could actually eat something. I mean, it doesn't, you know, even back in 1967 dollars, it's not very much.
Well,
and then if you brought in a few more people that put in, say, I think Bill Heinzman said he, you know, the shares were $300.
Yeah.
You know, if anything, it was, maybe $12,000 cash that you're actually working with.
So, you know, that's really what the film was made on. Conversely, you know, so that, you know, again, people get tied up in one figure and they kind of throw that around. And, you know, I don't like when things get, like, blown out of proportion like that. Like, they, you know, people just say a number and they don't think and, you know, don't investigate it further. It was made for very, very little actual cash. But conversely,
even with the little cash they had, they ran into problems because Regis Hrivinsky told us that his brother Vince was going to mortgage his house so they could have enough money to get the film needed, and but ended up getting the additional investors they needed so they didn't have to do it.
But then you also have to take into account that the film was actually made for a great deal more than $114,000, because you're talking about people's time. And, I mean, everybody there was, you know, at least among the core group, they, you know, if you guys had jobs, you had, you know, jobs doing this thing.
Well, exactly. I mean, what film has a director that has never made a director's fee? Or me as a sound man who was never, I never made a penny, nothing, for my, you know, my contribution to the film. That's crazy, you know. I mean, it wasn't like, okay, in the back end, everybody had kind of, you know, we kept tabs, and that was one of the things that got paid out of the money that came back to Image 10. That wasn't the case at all. So none of us, no one that actually worked on the film, of which there were probably only, I don't know, off the top of my head, I'm going to say there were six full-time people that worked on Night of the Living Dead, and then there were a few more, like Joe Unitas, that would bring in special times whenever we had. Joe Unitas was probably the only paid,
right, for hire crew member.
Yeah. I mean, no one else got paid a nickel for making Night of the Living Dead.
And most people had multiple jobs, too.
I'm sorry?
And most people had multiple jobs on the crew, too. You weren't like...
The core people worked at Leighton Image. I mean, the core people did. But yes, there were like a few of these auxiliary people that I'm talking about. They had other jobs, and we'd hire them for a weekend or a couple of days or whenever there were big scenes that we had to work on. So that kind of becomes A players. But there was not much outside resource other than the core group of Leighton Image that made the film, and for that, you know, for those blocks of time, we weren't working on anything else, but, you know, we were working on other things as soon as, you know, it went into editorial and stuff like that. I mean, and we had to kind of feed the Leighton Image kitty. All that sounds dramatic, but you know what? None of it was thought about. There was no thought about it. It was like, okay, how much money can we put together? Okay, well, I'll put up 600. So it was like, there it was. There wasn't any accountant saying, okay, you have enough 600s now, you can go ahead and make the film. The film was going to go on no matter what. Regis' comment, you know, about Vince putting his house up, you know, remortgaging his house, was that if that's what it took, if that's where it came, that was at least something we had in our back pocket to do it, you know. But also was never really none of this stuff was, if I could put it into a capsule of amount of time spent being thought about, it was very little. We were making the film, and that was it. And nobody was complaining. And that's kind of like one of the things that I think is really fun about it. There was no hierarchy. You know, George didn't really want to be the director, but he was the only one that sort of had, you know, at least the artistic ability. And he said it a lot of times. He was very uncomfortable being the director, and you know that.
Well, he was explain that a little bit more. His personality, from what I understand, was right. He's not the guy to like
be telling people what to do. And and people even say that to this day. I think there's, you know, obviously this respect for him. I'm sure he feels sometimes he walks in the room and he's like the guy with two heads. But people have always said he gets you to do what he wants you to do. You just want to please this guy because he's so low key the way he goes about directing. I mean, is that true?
I've always said it's absolutely true.
Right.
You know, I've always said that. If there was a rating of skill category, George's editorial ability far outshined his directorial ability, as far as I was concerned. I think he alluded to it earlier. I mean, somebody did. The editing of Night of the Living Dead is pretty seamless. I mean, considering everything, there's a couple jump cuts in it, but, you know, or cuts that don't quite work. But by and large, and I think that came from us, you know, working in a very sort of low-budget commercial world for as long as we did. And I think George was able, he edited enough of his own work to know what he needed to complete something. Jim, we have talked about it a couple of times, the infamous scene where, you know, Kyra finally kills her mother, which is probably the most haunting scene in the whole film to me.
I don't think that scene's been talked about enough. You know? And it's just amazing that here's a scene, at least, you know, when I was growing up, there was Psycho and the shower scene, and there was Night of the Living Dead in that scene. And so much has been written about the shower scene, you know, to the point where, you know, it has, like, mythic qualities. Well, you know, what are you actually seeing? I mean, they spent a week on that. People don't, you know, still don't know what you're actually seeing in that. Here's a scene in Night of the Living Dead that was probably shot in, what, a half hour? It has an even greater impact than this great scene in this Hitchcock movie. I don't think it's a mistake, you know, that the, you know, that somebody said, you know, a reviewer said from Pittsburgh, you know, scarier than Hitchcock, and the distributor ran with that because that's, you know, immediately identifiable. You know what people are talking about. And I still can't get out of everybody how that scene actually came about, you know, because it's not in any script.
It came about in George's head. Pure and simple.
Asking George about it, I mean, you really don't get, like, how did you get your mind about how you were going to do that? And I guess it came out of necessity. I mean, that's the bottom line. But,
yeah.
You know, the way he had to do it. But you never really get an answer, you know, how that
was put together,
how they managed to, you know, say, well, this, at this point, I mean, it's the perfect, just think of the shower scene in Psycho, like where it happens. And then think of where this scene happens in Night of the Living Dead. The film is going, it's, you know, literally and figuratively spiraling into, you know, down. You know, you literally go down into a basement, a darkened basement, and all of a sudden it's like one horrific image after the other. It's like at the perfect moment, you know, in the film to just nail the audience. When the audience, you know, they're already watching this film, there's other horrifying things in it, And they're probably, you know, that's amazing that in a film like Night of the Living Dead, you get to that point and you could still be shocked.
Not only with the images, but the music too. It was that combination hitting you in that scene. They're really good at it for me. I think it's better than Psycho.
That's what I was going to say. It didn't come all as one piece. You know, and that's the way George worked. George, as I said, had shot enough and had to edit enough of his own film through the commercial work and the industrial and work that we did that he knew how to he knew how to cover himself. You know, he knew if I get this angle, I get this angle, I get this angle, I can get into an editing room and edit something, you know, that will work. And that, so that was sort of phase one, to just get footage in the can. And then the second thing I would say is editorial, how he, you know, how he took those snips and cut them together. And then the third level is how he used music to punctuate all that. And
like right. cutting to the, you know, the jump cut to like the next scene. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the music that was, which, you know, was stock cues, which were, you know, pulled and, you know, had to be thought about, hey, this works right here. He knew enough to not have music in the, you know, there's another difference, not have music in his scene that's similar to Psycho, which has a brilliant score, but he knew how to also punctuate the ending of it. You know, he knew how to get out of it. And, you know, it just seemed the grisliest method of killing her off. Somebody thought of that, and it's amazing.
Yeah. We're almost running low on time, but I wanted to ask Jim something. I was just talking to Ken Kish tonight, and he says you guys are planning to bring some of the original zombies back at a future wasteland.
Oh, that was a big secret. Yeah,
he told me to say something.
What we were talking about. I went to Ken with the idea of you know, we've been doing you know, trying to get as many people from Night of the Living Dead to appear at conventions. You know, fans love meeting them, and you know, we've done, you know, larger and larger reunions. You know, Gary had a festival out in Evans City, which was amazing, which is out where the film was shot. And we just noticed from doing these shows, and especially the last Cinema Wasteland show that had Russ Striner, Gary, and Judy Ridley, we just noticed that, you know, the smaller groups like that tend to do very, very well in terms of, I guess it's not overwhelming for the fans to walk into a room and there's 12 to 15 people from the film. Maybe that's a little too much. So unless you're doing like Gary's event where, you know, that is the theme of the event, Night of the Living Dead, and actually having a festival where the film was shot, I mean, that's a very unique idea. And, you know, that's much different than, you know, than typical horror conventions. So, you know, in seeing that at the last Cinema Wasteland, you know, the group did very well. And, you know, we know that Judy does well because she's kind of a latecomer to conventions and she hasn't done very many of them.
Yeah.
So people tend to, you know, they're coming out to see her because she's the rare autograph that they haven't got on their poster from the last 10 years of collecting signatures. You know, that much is understood, but to see like Russ do very, very well when, you know, he jokes all the time. He says, I think everybody has a Johnny signature in the world that could possibly want one by this point, but he still does pretty well because I think when you have a good group, a good small group, you know, kind of everybody working together and you present it that way, the fans just respond very well to that. And I have people come up all the time and say, hey, how can I get, you know, I want to get the people that were ghouls, you know, or the people that portrayed ghouls that I got to see for the first time in the documentary. How do I get their signature? So really, Cinema Wasteland's the only show that could possibly pull off that idea. It's close enough to Pittsburgh that you could get some of the people out that don't really do shows. And, you know, they would just be lost in some of the larger shows or the shows that are, you know, just branching out into all different areas, not just, you know, classic horror. And Cinema Wasteland, you know, is, you know, definitely, you know, sticks with what it does best, which is the classic horror, you know, exploitation films, the stuff from the 70s, you know, right there, you know, that group of people would be at home. So that's what we're planning to bring out, some first-timers.
Well, I just got the two-minute warning, so we got to wrap it up. Where can the fans pick up this DVD other than the conventions?
Well, autopsyofthedead.com or on Amazon. Just put in Autopsy of the Dead, and it pops up on Amazon.
I sat down. God's truth, I was mesmerized. It was, you know, like you said, it touched on a lot, you know, things where no one has gone before, and it was, you know, completely mesmerizing to me, and I learned a lot from it. And I want to thank you guys for coming on. Maybe we'll have you on again sometime. When we get closer to Wasteland, we'll do something, you know, when we do that whole thing. Maybe we'll have some of the ghouls on.
That sounds great. I think they'd love it.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. You know,
Gary's, you know, before we sign off, you know, Gary's mom, I don't know if you know this, but she's probably the oldest living cast member of Night of the Living Dead. And I didn't find that out until I met Gary. So,
cool.
Yeah, 93 years old.
Wow.
That's awesome.
We actually had the Wall Street Journal contacted one of the conventions I was at, and they said, well, talk to Jim, and the reporter, you know, contacted me, and she was basically, the angle that she went with was, you know, the oldest surviving members in the cast. She specifically wanted to talk to, you know, the people that were in their 80s and 90s, if we could find them, and we did, and Gary's mom was on the front page of Wall Street Journal.
Well, again, I want to thank you guys for coming on, and that's it for this week, and we'll have something equally as entertaining and crazy as next week, so until then, stay sick, and we'll see you then.
Dominate your dreams. They're all yours right here in the Grindhouse.
So grab your-